Welcome to all of you. It's good to see you. In the interest of full disclosure, you see this name up here. Faith Alive Christian Resources is the publishing ministry of the Christian Reformed Church. And as about a year ago, I took over as editor-in-chief. And so this we produce a product, a resource called Disciples. And so at the very end of this, I will be talking maybe for 5 minutes about disciples. I wanted you to know that this is part of that whole process, and I was a part of the editing and putting that resource together. That doesn't take away from what I'm saying about discipleship and its importance in the Christian life. Where are we here? It's always exciting when you look working in somebody else's domain with electronic material. Talk a little bit about the biblical basis of discipleship. Discipleship was Jesus' method of reaching the world with the good news of the kingdom of God. And what's important to understand about that is that, as always, God was reaching out to the world in an incarnational way. Jesus, of course, is the incarnate Son of God. But how he operated was also incarnational. That it had to do with the world in which he lived. And what's important about that is that in the life, the world of Second Temple Judaism, which he lived, this relationship of rabbi and disciple was the ordinary way in which, let's say, deep religious teaching was done. There were a number of rabbis who had various points of view, you might say, on the scriptures, and they gathered disciples around them. In fact, the evidence of the Gospels is that Jesus himself was a disciple before he was a rabbi. Anybody know who Jesus was a disciple of? Exactly, John the Baptist. It's really interesting if you look in the first chapter of the Gospel of John, Jesus emerges out of this circle of disciples of John the Baptist. And the picture that's sort of painted there is that John the Baptist gradually comes to this sense that this disciple of his is unique. And he begins to say things about him. And, this is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. This is the person. I'm not worthy to untie his sandals. And so Jesus spins out of the orbit of the disciples of John and becomes himself a rabbi. And the picture is very clear because after John says these things, Jesus sort of walks off. And two people who were also disciples of John follow him. And this was actually the lectionary text for last week. They say to Jesus, "Where do you live?" And Jesus said, "Come and see." And that was, in John's Gospel, his invitation to discipleship for Peter and for Andrew, and then they went out and got Nathaniel. So Jesus was operating in this context of disciple-rabbi. In fact, there's lots of stuff that's written about that, but for sort of a quick and dirty and easy way of looking at it, Ray Vanderlaan has an interesting website with some pretty good stuff on it called, I think, The Rabbi and His Talmudim, which gives a picture of this kind of relationship in Second Temple Judaism. Now, as always, Jesus transformed this model of rabbi and disciple, and it came out looking quite different than some of the other rabbis and disciples. One way of looking at it is to look at this text. Those of you here, I would imagine there's some of you who are preachers. I wouldn't have tackled this text before I really thought about it in the way I'm going to mention right now. These are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, also known as Peter, and his brother Andrew, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. Now, of course, we know from the context of the Gospels that these were all fishermen, families. And that's the thing I wanted to point out about them. They are families. These are related people to each other. And you see this relationship going through the Gospels, that one brother talks to another brother, and they have to leave Zebedee the father, and there's all kinds of family dynamics going on. You go into Peter's house, and his mother-in-law is there. There's family stuff going on. I've always missed that in the Gospels. But in fact, it belongs to the Scriptures and the way that God always operates, doesn't it? God created families, and one of the ways, not the only way, but one of the ways that God brings people to himself is through families. So you have the brothers, just like in most churches, you have some extended families, and oftentimes we found out that in evangelization, one of the best ways in which to reach people is through somebody, especially a new Christian, who can reach out to their brother or sister or cousin or aunt or uncle or whatever it is. And you have Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas, and then you have Matthew the tax collector, James son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot. Now take those two in italics there, Matthew the tax collector and Simon the Zealot. To put it into modern political language, and this isn't entirely accurate, we could say that Matthew the tax collector was right-wing, and Simon the Zealot was left-wing. Matthew the tax collector was basically a government agent for the Roman occupiers, collecting taxes. Simon the Zealot was oftentimes the revolutionaries, violent revolutionaries even, who were about the overthrow of the occupation. Now, I always wondered what kind of conversations these folks had around as they were talking together, you know? These two people at political extremes are a part of Jesus' first community of disciples. And then, of course, you got right at the end, Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed him. Of course, you know, Judas was there too, but he was there. He was one of the disciples. Frederick Dale Bruner has a wonderful few sentences about this in his masterful commentary on the Gospel of Matthew, his theological commentary. He talks about the fact that as Judas is listed here among the disciples, we realize that it's never a surprise that radical evil is in the middle of the church. Boy, was that a comfort to me when I read that. We're always surprised, aren't we, when something terrible happens and when Christians do things awful to each other? Well, it was right there at the beginning. It was part of the community that Jesus chose at the beginning, which signals us you're always going to find radical evil. You're always going to find betrayal in the life of the church. So don't be surprised. That is, don't tolerate it, but don't be surprised by it, because it's always there. So this is a very strange and interesting kind of community of disciples. Probably not the pick of the crop, you might say, as most rabbis would want to have. Jesus sort of transforms this construct of disciple, of rabbi and discipleship in his own way. One way of looking at what a disciple is, I found that the best analogy, I think, in modern culture is to think about an apprentice. This is how disciples learn and grow. They're apprentices. And an apprentice is somebody who gets on-the-job training. Normally, an apprentice, and this is usually in the building trades, electrician, anybody gone through an apprenticeship here? Building trades, electronics, plumbing, that sort of thing. You get on the job. And I always imagined it would be a tough thing for an apprentice those first few weeks or months in the job, just sort of standing around watching people, looking at what they do. In every one of these trades, there's a culture. There's a language. You talk about transformers, and you talk about for masonry, fragging the brick or the mortar. You learn a language and a culture by gradually absorbing it and being part of it, and you start to talk the language too. So, but it's on-the-job training. You don't go off to community college. You don't go off to college and say, well, you come back after 4 years and then you're going to be a an electrician or something. No, you get on the job and you work with the people that are doing it. And you do it by observing them. So the disciples were with Jesus and they observed what he was doing. They saw how he interacted with the sick, healing them. They saw how he interacted with sinners. They saw how he interacted with other teachers of the law and Pharisees and so forth. A part of an apprenticeship also is teaching. There are some things that you just have to learn. You have to know, and oftentimes it's working right with the master and learning those things. We see Jesus teaching very often to his disciples as well as to the larger crowds. But finally, at the end, an apprentice has to do it themselves. And I imagine, you know, finally let's say you're an apprentice electrician, and take your tools, and the foreman of that job says, "Now, you're going to wire up this room. You're going to do it. And nobody's going to be there with you. You're going to do it." I always love those stories in the Gospels where Jesus sends out the 12, sends out the 70, and what do? They do the same thing that Jesus does. They heal the sick. They preach the gospel, the good news of peace. They raise the dead. They cast out demons. All the stuff that Jesus did. And they teach people. All the stuff that Jesus did, the disciples did. They have been apprentices, and now they're going to do the job. And then they come back. And Jesus said, "Well, how'd it go?" And they said, "Wow! The demons fled at your name, and the sick were healed, and the dead were raised. It was great." And Jesus says, "Well, you know, I saw Satan falling from heaven." In other words, now you're on the job. Now you're doing my work. Now things are going to happen because you're doing what I called you to do when you're carrying out the training that I gave to you. I want to talk a little bit about discipleship and disciples in the book of Acts. It's sometimes overlooked, I think. First of all, it's important to realize that this is Luke's second letter to Theophilus, and he begins it by saying, "You remember, Theophilus, all the things that Jesus began to do and to teach." Now, the implication of that is, what I'm going to tell you is what Jesus continues to do and to teach. But, of course, Jesus, by the first chapter, is gone. He's off the scene. He's ascended to heaven. And so what Jesus continues to do and to teach, he does through his disciples, through the apostles and through others that they, in turn, call and train into the life of the church. I think the word disciple or disciples is used about 27 times in the book of Acts. It's used to describe a variety of people. Dorcas Tabitha, for example, is one. I'm sorry?
Yeah, I was looking for female examples.
Yes,
just
right.
Name one.
And there was another one, too, but I can't remember which one.
Priscilla and Aquila?
I don't know if they were actually termed disciples, but they certainly are. Maybe they would be more called apostles.
Yes, but they learned it from Paul.
They learned from Paul, that's right. So, in Acts, again, disciples do what Jesus did. The first thing that Peter does is he preaches the gospel of the kingdom, and then in chapter 3, he's going out healing people, right? And they raise the dead, and they cast out demons. All the stuff that Jesus did is carried out in the gospel of Acts because these disciples now are continuing to do what Jesus did. Paul is, in a sense, a supreme example, I think, of the disciple. You see in how he operates. He always travels, not with 12 people. I don't think 12 people could really live with Paul. He was kind of a cantankerous guy. But he had these traveling companions all the time, Apollos and John Mark and Luke and others and Silas and so forth. And he was always training people. He was always training people on the job that he was doing. But even more important, his life sort of followed the contour of his master. One of the things that Luke emphasizes in the book of Acts is that Paul suffered. I mean, he was beaten and stoned and left for dead and imprisoned and whipped and you name it. He was suffering throughout his life. And even though it's never actually described, the implication is that Paul's life will end at the book of Acts, and we know it does end in the same way that, that Jesus died. Now, a little look at the epistles. Now, Paul, in his epistles, I'll mainly talk about Paul, was writing to primarily into a Greek and Roman culture, even though he was also communicating with people who were Jews. Nevertheless, it was outside of the Palestinian culture, the Second Temple Judaism culture of Palestine. And so they were not as they were not familiar with this rabbinic tradition, and so Paul probably had to find different words, different ways of expressing the same thing. And he used a number of different ways of talking about Jesus. First of all, very importantly, he talks about Jesus or Christ as the second Adam. He is the new human being whom God has sent. He is the model for how we live. And then that we are new creations in Christ by baptism, through our baptism and faith. And that the whole point is that Christ is the new human being. We become new people through him. And we grow up to be like Christ. My favorite text on this, is because I'm a Calvinist, is Romans 8, verse 29. We are... lost the word all of a sudden. Predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. That God predestined us to be conformed to the image of his Son. Which means that election is all about discipleship. Election is about us becoming like Jesus. Now, and of course this happens in the transforming power of the Holy Spirit. My point here, oh, the other thing. Paul's method that he talks about is imitation. How often in Paul's letters doesn't he say something like, imitate me, do what I do? That always intimidated me as a pastor. I thought about, would I ever say to somebody, just imitate me? Wow, no, I don't think so. I know myself. I know I'm not the kind of person you want to imitate. Life you always want to imitate, follow exactly. But of course, Paul wasn't a perfect person either. What he was saying was, follow along with me as I struggle to become a disciple of Jesus Christ. Calling somebody to imitate you, to walk with you on the Christian life, invite them into discipleship, does not say, you've got it all together. It's saying, you are on your way trying to follow Christ, and you can come along with me, knowing that I'm on my way following Jesus Christ. Now, bottom line, the point. If you want to look at the Paul, compare Paul with the Gospels, or the letters with the Gospels, you can describe it as discipleship in terms of the Gospel. But you could talk about it as spiritual formation when you look about it, at it from the point of view of Paul's epistles. And there's been a lot of stuff, you know, back and forth written about discipleship and spiritual formation as though they're sort of two different things. Where actually, I think they're the very same thing. It just depends on where you're looking in the New Testament. It all has to do, ultimately, with becoming like Jesus and doing what Jesus does. Okay, now let's tackle the big text, Matthew 28, verses 19 and 20. This is a literal translation of that text, literally from the Greek. Don't ask me too much about the Greek because I am not a Greek scholar. Going therefore, disciple you all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey all things whatever I gave command to you. Now, if you look at this literal translation, one of the helpful things about it is that it keeps verbs, verbs, and nouns, nouns. What's the only verb in this sentence? Disciple. Now, we've changed it in our translation. How does it read? The typical translation.
Go,
therefore. That, the first verb, that's the one that grabs your attention, right? Go. All right. Go make disciples of all the nations. nations. So go make disciples of all nations. And then even less better than the other one. You know, so it's it has become very much traditionally a missionary text. Now I'm not saying it's not a missionary text, but I'm saying that the verb here is disciple. So obviously that's what it's about. Let's look a little bit more closely at it. It has that missional emphasis, and I'm looking at more the goal here rather than to make disciples. We are to make disciples, and we are to do that wherever we are. It's across the world. It's in our own congregations. There's also, and this is, I think, widely overlooked, discipleship training circles. There's a baptismal, a sacramental emphasis here. Baptizing them. I used to think that when Jesus said baptizing them, he really meant converting them. You know, because when you convert somebody, then they get baptized. But I don't think he was saying that. And here's how to look at that. If you look at the beginning of the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 3, you have the story of Jesus' baptism. That was the beginning of his ministry according to Matthew's gospel. What happened at his baptism? Well, the heavens opened, the Spirit descended on him like a dove, and the voice from heaven said, "You are my beloved, and you I am well pleased," or Peterson translates it, "I'm delighted in you," or "You're my delight," or something like that. Or it can come to, "I really like you." I always loved to have God say to me, "You're my son, I really like you." Anyway, that was Jesus' baptism, and as I emphasize in the other talk that I give at this workshop, Jesus' baptism is the model for our baptism. In baptism, God is saying to us, "The heavens are open, my grace is shining on you, the Spirit is the gift, and you are my beloved sons and daughters. In you I am well pleased." This was the moment of Jesus' identity. God said, "This is who you are," and he sent him on his mission. Baptism is the moment of our identity. God tells us who we are, and out of that identity comes our mission. Knowing that we are persons who are baptized into Jesus Christ to be like him, and therefore we then become his disciples and we make disciples. So that baptizing them is an important aspect of when we understand the full scope and orb of what baptism means. Teaching them, there's always an instructional aspect to discipling. There's things that have to be taught. Just like we talked about before in the apprenticeship, there's a language to be learned. There's a tendency today in the church that we want to get rid of sort of ecclesiastical or theological language because people won't understand it. Maybe we need to think about it in the same way that an electrician would think about it or a plumber would think about it and say, "No, you have to learn a language here because this is our culture. This is the way we operate. And there are certain practices and certain words and certain concepts that you need to learn to be a part of this." And so that has to be taught to you. And you also sort of live into it as you're living in the community. And then to obey everything I have commanded you, the faith formation emphasis. Fundamentally, faith, if any of you heard Kenneth Bailey this morning, faith and obedience were brought together. He said, we're talking about the same thing here. When you believe, you obey. If you say you believe and you don't obey, you don't really believe. That's ultimately what faith is, to obey the things that Jesus commanded us. It's wonderful that Dallas Willard is here, and I don't know why I'm talking about discipleship when Dallas Willard is here, but in one of his books, I can't remember which one, he has this little illustration about what if you were driving down the street and you looked at one of these ubiquitous church signs, and the church sign said, "We teach you to do everything that Jesus commanded you." Would you go to that church? That was his question. We kind of look at that church as being odd. It's maybe a little cultish. It's exactly what Jesus told us to do. We're supposed to teach our people and our churches to obey Christ, to do what He told us to do, to love our enemies, to forgive. All those to turn the other cheek, all those hard things that He talks about in the Sermon on the Mount, for example, we teach our people how to do that. George Barna says the Great Commission is not primarily about evangelism, it's about discipleship. Let me stop here a minute and see if you have any questions or comments. I see something emerging here, no?
I come from our church, but the last little while with the pastor, and he's been always emphasizing, go! But we're not building up the people with learning the message that we're supposed to carry of kids.
Yeah. I'll be talking about that in a minute, about how churches relate to this kind of concept of discipleship and congregation.
That is the Greek. The Greek emphasis, that's it.
Disciple. You said, going, in other words, on your way, as you're leaving this spot, make disciples. It wasn't so much, go somewhere else and make disciples. At least as I interpret that passage.
Yeah. Related to that thought, then, going back to the John passage that you mentioned, where Jesus says, come and see where I live.
Yeah.
There's a different direction, it seems, that Jesus is essentially inviting you into the circle, and that's where the apprenticeship happens. Rather than we tend to think about evangelism as something that happens on the street corner, primarily outside of the community. And I wonder if there's something ecclesiological implied in John.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Certainly. Following up on that, discipleship is something that can happen outside the community in a sense. For example, I may have a neighbor, and I may, just by living out of things, talk about what I believe in and my story, and how my story is connected with the biblical story and so forth. But I'm an extension of the community. I'm never cut off from the community, sort of doing my evangelism thing out there. And it seems to me that discipling and discipleship is primarily a community concept, but it's not a closed community concept. That community is always open, and it's always discipling. It is always bringing people into it, in the community itself, and then as those people reach out to the people that they're naturally related to, not as their blood relation, but their jobs or whatever. Think about discipleship in the church today, as we were beginning to be led. When I started my job, as I said a year ago, my supervisor handed me a book called Simple Church. And Simple Church is a simple book. It's not any deep theology. Basically it asks the question, what are we about? What are we about in the church today? What is the main thing? Now, you might ask, and the book says, well, are the leaders clear about what the main thing is that what we're doing? And are congregation members clear? Now, I would dare say that in most of our congregations, at least, certainly the ones that I've served, you go out and ask people, what's the main thing here? You come up with a variety of things. And somebody would say, worship. Man, the worship service is the main thing that's going on here. Can't argue with that. Youth program. It's our youth. It's the future is in our youth. Let's put our money and time and effort into that one. Evangelism. Small groups. That's what we're about. We're a small group congregation. The folks who wrote this book make one point. Say, our job is what Jesus said, to disciple, to make disciples. A number of examples of churches that are talked about there and what they have done. This is hard. This is not easy stuff. They simplified their ministry. Said, If it isn't about discipling, then it doesn't happen here. That's a hard thing to do. In fact, I know several churches. Give an example that I read about. It's public. The Church of Joy, I think it was, in Phoenix or something. There was a big, huge mega church in Arizona, and they said, "Hey, what were we doing? We're putting on extravaganzas, getting people to come to worship services. What's happening to these people's lives? Nothing. So let's make disciples." Well, the church shrunk by half, because people were brought into teams where they began to actually follow Jesus and do the things that Jesus did. So this is not the answer to church growth. This is what Jesus told us to do. And he told us to do it not because it's going to make us huge and successful and the world's going to look at us and say it's wonderful, but that this is how the world is transformed. So ask those simple questions. What are we about? Look at the programs, the life of the church. What does it do? Another church that they talked about organized their whole church life into two things around Jesus' great commandment. Love God above all. There were things around that. Worship. Teaching. Love your neighbor as yourself. The ministry that comes out of that. That's pretty simple. Everybody in the church can understand that, right? Everything that we do fits into those two things. And that's about following Jesus, because that's what he told us is God's great command to us, or for us to do. Does that help you a little bit in what you were talking about?
Yeah.
It's about, in other words, what I'm saying is that this call of making disciples begins in the church. It isn't, we're not talking about, first of all, something out there that we go to some other country and make disciples, or some other city and make disciples, that we start by making disciples right where we are. And the trouble is that most people don't understand that that's what they're supposed to be. They think they're just supposed to be churchgoers. Not necessarily. I mean, a lot of people have this sense of a disciple is this super Christian. You know, that's way up here. I'm just an ordinary garden variety Christian. And, you know, I struggle along. I go to church and I give my money, but don't ask much more of me.
Actually, our pastors are sensing the two paradigms that he sees is that some churches see the mission field as those within the walls of the church, other people see the mission field as those outside the walls of the church. I think it's a bit of both ends.
It's both ends. Yes, I think that's right. Yeah, somebody maybe want to argue the other way, but... famous quote from Dallas Willard, non-discipleship is the elephant in the church. You know that elephant in the room thing. What feeds the elephant and keeps it strong is the absence. This is pure Dallas Willard. He probably talked like this in his speech today. The absence of effectual programs of training that enable his people to do what Jesus said in a regular and efficient manner. I love that. In other words, the church isn't teaching people to do what Jesus told them to do. Here's a quote from him that I really like. I've used it in sermons, and it really shocks people out of their seat. He talks about vampire Christians as opposed to disciples. The vampire Christian says to Jesus, "I'd like a little of your blood, but I don't care to be your student, disciple. In fact, won't you just excuse me while I get on with my life, and I'll see you in heaven?" That's, you know, come on, that's really... Don't tell me that that's what I'm thinking, but this is an exact description of what, let me be honest, what I have said to Jesus at times in my life. Let me get on with my life, will you? With my life. Because I don't think necessarily that I want to live your life and be your disciple. Because it's too darn hard. So, but that's what it's about. I want Jesus and I want the benefits of Jesus, but I don't really want to follow him. But that's what he called me to do. This is a definition of discipleship that comes from the discipleship team of the RCA, Reformed Church in America, which I think is just an excellent one. Discipleship, Christian discipleship, is the process of following Jesus Christ and becoming like him in all we think, say, and do. You notice several things here. It's a process. It doesn't happen at once. It's following Jesus Christ to become like Him.
Yeah.
And it involves everything about it, what we think, what we say, and what we do. And then it has a purpose. Being the very presence of Christ in a lost and broken world so loved by God. Why did Jesus come here? Be God's presence in the world. So we become Christ's presence in the world by being like Him, because that world is so much loved by God. Wonderful definition of discipleship, I think. Wonderful thing for all of us to keep in mind. We need to be moving on. I don't think I'm going to go through this whole thing here. You've got it on a slide. If you want to look at it further, you can do that. Well, I got time. Maybe I will go through it. Well, when does this thing end?
1 hour.
No, it doesn't.
10 minutes.
It ends at 10:02?
Yeah.
Okay. This is something that I think it was something that I worked out with a colleague in the congregation to help the congregation understand some of the things that discipleship is and some of the things that it isn't. Discipleship or spiritual formation, and we use both of those terms, is essential, not optional, for Christ followers. You don't have a choice about it. If you're going to follow Christ, you become a disciple. It's a process, not an event. This is important. Like, a lot of people think that, especially those who grew up in a strongly evangelical and revivalist tradition, that it's something that happens to you. You get this experience, and it happens to you suddenly. It is God's work. Discipleship is God's work, but it requires my participation. Good, solid Reformed theology. It's not compartmentalized pursuit. God is not interested in my spiritual life. He's interested in my life, in all of it. Some of you perhaps have read Eugene Peterson's books about pastoring, you know, and he's always writing about spirituality. He's very clear about what he means by spirituality. If somebody would come to him and say, well, you know, I'm a pastor and I want to become more spiritual, he'd say, well, go back home and love your wife, be with your kids, and love your neighbor and do their lawn, be spiritual. It's got to do with the nitty-gritty stuff of our life. It's not airy-fairy stuff out here somewhere. It's not just happening in prayer. It happens at the dinner table. It happens in driving to work. It happens in all kinds of ways. It can happen in any moment, any circumstances, not restricted to certain times or practices. We usually think of our becoming disciples or spiritual formation, you know, we're practicing the spiritual disciplines or whatever. It happens in all kinds of ways, and so oftentimes we are surprised by how the Spirit works in our lives through various circumstances. It's not individualistic, but takes place in community and finds expression in serving others. It's not impeded by a person's background, temperament, past sins, present struggles, or seasons of life. This is something that we often run into when you invite people into a discipling relationship. You say, well, I can't do that because you know who I am. You know all the ways in which I've screwed up and messed up my life. That doesn't make any difference. Look at Jesus' disciples. They were all messed up people. It's available right now for those who desire it. The means of pursuing it will vary from one person to another. Followers of Christ are handcrafted, not mass-produced. There's a key one, too. We tend to think that we can turn the church into a disciple factory. And we're going to turn out people that sort of look the same and think the same and all that kind of stuff. No. Everybody is different. And every Christian is different. Every follower of Christ is different. And they have different outlooks and personalities and ways of acting and gifts and all those kinds of things. All of that goes into what you are as disciples. So you don't... What your discipleship looks like can be very, very different from what somebody else's discipleship looks like. And don't judge somebody else's discipleship and following Christ because you are built differently than they are. It's ultimately gauged by an increased capacity to love God and people. No superficial or legalistic checklist can measure So there's a list that I thought you might find to be helpful.
Battery low or something there?
There. Causes for concern. Few churches or Christians have a clear, measurable goal of training disciples. I'm just throwing it up, and I think that's the case. I know one church, Christian Reformed Church on the West Coast, that had as their mission statement, being disciples and making disciples of Jesus Christ. That's it. And everybody in that congregation knows that that's what the mission statement is, that's what they're about. But there are a few congregations that know that. You walk into most congregations and say, what are we about? Or what is it that we're expecting you to be and become and do? Will people say a disciple of Jesus? Uh-huh. Maybe not.
Then can you speculate why that might be, given what you've said already, that this is a name of Jesus? Like churches?
Well, my speculation would be that it's simply not taught, not clearly taught in the church. Again, talk about my own growing up and maturing as a Christian, that text, make disciples, was about mission work. It had anything to do with me, because I wasn't a missionary. And so the expectation wasn't clearly laid out that all followers of Christ are disciples of Christ, and that we are predestined to be conformed to the image of Christ. Christ is Christ is out there. He's something different. He saves us. But the idea of our actually becoming like him, it's not so prevalent and clear.
Not to put you on the spot in this place, but what would have to change, in your view, in the seminary curriculum to produce pastors produce disciples in their churches?
I think what would have to change is that whether it's in theology or whether it's a course in pastoral practice, that this is the number one thing. What you're about as a pastor, and what everybody ultimately is about in the church, is making disciples. That happens in lots of different ways, but that's the goal. I would hope that if seminary students would have that as their... If in every course practically it was laid on them, and this is about what we're doing, that would be effective. We think of this, especially in our tradition, the Reformed tradition. We think of. Does somebody have a question?
Yeah.
Okay. As long as you're not talking about worship as worship services, though, I think that worship services are important and central. You're not going to follow Christ if you don't love him. You know, love God. And you love God because God sent his Son to become like you and to raise you up into the fellowship of the divine Trinity and to become part of that circle of love. That's been wonderful. Now, if you aren't sort of struck by that and think, man, God loves me so much and I love God so much in return, then, yeah, discipleship is going to be an abstract concept, I think. It ultimately has to be about that passion of loving God and loving Jesus, and therefore wanting to follow him. Glad you injected that. Discipleship as head knowledge rather than what Dallas Willard calls renovation of the heart. We major in that in our Reformed tradition anyway. You know, you just keep on learning stuff. But that idea of on-the-job training, getting out and doing things, is not so much emphasized. There's almost, we go about discipleship randomly rather than systematically. In fact, when in our Faith Alive, when we were contemplating, the way we began to contemplate discipleship there was that we looked at all of our adult education offerings. And we had some Bible studies, and we had things, all kinds of stuff. But it's a hodgepodge. And so we realize that we have a curriculum for children and youth. Say, no, there's things you got to learn. You got to, you know, learn these texts, and you got to go through the scope and sequence of understanding the Bible and all this kind of stuff. And then when they get out of high school, you say, well, whatever. We don't have a curriculum for adults. Now, I'm not saying that disciples is the curriculum for adults. I'm saying that in the church, we have to get a new mindset that adults are in school. They're in discipleship school. And because they need to learn and grow as disciples of Jesus Christ. And in my view of looking at churches, most adult education classes are very poorly attended. There's not any expectation there. The church doesn't expect people to grow as disciples of Christ, and they're not going to. Expectation is a huge, huge thing. Then there is almost no spiritual accountability in most congregations. I was at a meeting about a year ago in which there was a representative of Gallup organization there. Gallup, most of us know Gallup as a political polling organization, but Gallup, George Gallup, who runs it, is a Christian, a Presbyterian. I mean they're the same. There's a very strong arm of Gallup organization that helps churches to see what the life of the church through various kinds of polling and testing and so forth. Anyway, he's developed a tool for churches to assess the spiritual life of their congregations. And that's not a long one, but one of the questions in that tool is, has anybody in your congregation talked to you about your spiritual life or your walk with God in the last year? That question scored the lowest across the board, every denomination, every church, all across America. What does that say? We don't have any accountability with each other. Nobody talks to us, not even pastors, about what is going on in your life with Christ. And we don't even have the language to talk about it. That's where we have to start. We don't know how to talk about that with one another. That's why we don't, usually. We don't talk about it with our children sometimes. You know how to talk? It's hard to talk with your teenager about their relationship with Christ and what's happening with that. And I'm not sure a lot of us have the language to do that. So if there's no spiritual, if nobody's asking us about it, what's the implication? Well, it's not very important. Or it's something that just happens privately. Yeah.
To follow up on Peter's question, if the seminary did get seminary students to have that as their top priority, chances are when they go to a new church, it's going to be a foreign concept. So where would you suggest they start? I mean, even to get spiritual discipline or accountability from the elders might be a big project just to start there. So what would you suggest?
Obviously, to me, you aren't going to change everything in a year. I think that list of characteristics of spiritual formation is a process. That will be a process in a church as well. And I think a pastor would sort of have to balance two things. The one thing is that you have a goal that you want to get to. You want to awaken this sense of discipleship and spiritual formation in the life of the congregation, but that you don't want to sort of destroy the congregation as you're doing that. On the other hand, it takes a kick in the pants. It takes sometimes to let people folks know that they're actually being vampires in order to get there. So it's that delicate balance that. You only can tell with prayer and understanding and talking to people how you get to that point. I don't think there's any one answer because every congregation is different and every pastor is different. But if the goal is there and if the leadership over a period of time, I think that's where you probably start with leadership of the church. You're discipling them first because they're going to have the effect of bringing other people along. So that would be one important place to start. I'm not very good at strategery. Okay, here, we invest our greatest training resources and expectations in children rather than adults. Now, I work for Faith Alive Christian Resources, and children's curricula is our bread and butter, folks. My boss knew that I was saying this, he'd kill me. But here's the thing. This is from called Net Results. Even a 10% increase in serious, intentional adult spiritual growth can offset operating deficits, increase volunteerism for children and youth ministries. In the end, adult spiritual growth multiplies mission to all generations. You always hear it in the church. We have to put our effort, time, and youth, and for the children, of course you do. You have to train your children. But listen, if children, every poll tells us the same thing. Children look to their parents and other significant adults in their life as the model. It doesn't look like it to us, but they're still doing it. They're looking at us all the time. Now, if the adults in the church are not at all serious about being disciples of Jesus Christ, they don't really study the Bible, the children don't see them going to some kind of adult education program or trying to develop their faith. They're just, the garden variety Christian order. What are they going to think? You can teach me all you want about the Bible, but I know that it ain't important because it isn't important to you and how you live your life. That's why adult ministry is the key to evangelization. You can't start with the children. You have to start with the adults because that's the model that everybody's looking to. Where do we go from here? A passion for making disciples as the fundamental business of the church. Clear, simple, repeated statement of the goal to make disciples. That's so important. Talking about the process, you just keep on saying it. We're about discipling. We're about becoming disciples. And you say it in all kinds of ways. You say it in the liturgy and every way you can think of. Expectations and accountability to foster spiritual growth. People live up to the expectations that the church has for them, the leadership has. Now, let's talk a little bit about disciples, the program of Faith Alive. Just what we need, another program. By the way, I want to say before I say anything more about the program that this is one of many ways in which to carry out discipleship in the church. There's one important way is one-on-one, two-on-one discipleship. It's really intense kind of thing. Another is a more educational method, that is to get people in classrooms to teach them about the Bible and about the spiritual disciplines. So this particular program is a small group-based program. It's small groups meeting together and studying what it means to be a disciple. It's a multi-year faith formation program for adults. I think the important thing is multi-year. We're talking about a curriculum here, basically, even though it's a small group-based thing. We're not saying it's 40 days of this or 40 days of that. We're saying it's 3 years, at least, of discipleship. Year one, it lays the foundation for understanding and practicing discipleship. It's 25 weeks in total, divided into 5 modules with 5 weeks each. Basically, 1 hour small group Bible study. This is small commitment Bible study. By small commitment, I say that a person could go to a group and not have read anything before. We do that because that's what most people do. I'm sorry, folks. That's the way it is. So we designed this first year saying, okay, we're just going to get you to these groups. And hopefully out of this, people will grow in their desire to become disciples of Jesus Christ and grow in their desire to study more, to read more about what it means. And there's in our particular program, there's a kickoff period, which may help the church to sort of say, this is our serious business. There's 5 weeks of worship services. There's a book of daily readings that covers 5 weeks that goes along with while small groups are gathering for the first module called Follow Me. Years two and three were just produced. Year two will be out in April. They took cue from Jesus' words. I talked about it a little while ago, love the Lord your God. The second year focuses on spiritual practices or disciplines of disciples. We're looking at the main spiritual disciplines. We think of prayer, worship, living in community, reading the Bible. And obviously there are lots of other spiritual disciplines, and people can get into those later, but we want to lay these down right away. And then it's not up on this slide, but we also have one coming this year called Overcoming Sin. It deals with the seven deadly sins, which are as relevant and important today as they ever were in the history of the church. Now, the commitment level in year two is radically different. For each one of the small group sessions, there are five daily readings from a page and a half to 2 pages long. They are sort of devotional in nature and instructional. Devotional and instructional at the same time. The idea being that if you do these five readings, that when you come to the group, you're going to have some material to talk about. You're going to have who will have thought about these things, prayed about them, made lists about them, or whatever was asked of you to do in those devotions. So the commitment level grows as you get into the program. Year three, love your neighbor as yourself, focuses on the more missional aspects. How do we live as Christ disciples in our families and in our communities and in the world? And probably one of the really helpful things about it is we developed a website to go with it called growdisciples.org. And what this does is, right now it's all out in the first year, for each one of those small group sessions, small group modules, for each session, you can click on a link, and it will bring you to, okay, you want it, let's say you're talking about spiritual disciplines. There is a small segment on spiritual disciplines in the first year. Well, there's a link that you want to follow that further. Here's some readings, articles on prayer, here's some articles on reading the Bible, and a number of other things. So individually, those people in the group can say, okay, I want to learn more about this. So they go to the website, and they can follow it up. I'm just running out of time here. So, that's it, folks.
Novel face, but it's like that.
It's too simple.
The question was, what practical material can you recommend to me to do something like this in my church. And this would have been
answered. Well, there's, this is one. There's all kinds of others.
I was surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Years ago, you were on the band.
That's a beautiful
I see.
Glad that God is at work. I remember writing that. That was a huge thing because so many people were guilty about that. So the more guilt you feel, the less you're going to do it. So it's that kind of sense of it's not that God is willing to check, coming how many times we go. It's just what you can feel, what is the relationship with
now, are you familiar with this? Creek?
I know that there's been a interesting thing. There's been a
But I'll figure it out. I'll figure it out. It's prayer.
That's certainly not wrong, but
it doesn't change people.